Louis Ferranti has a story so fascinating that it's already been optioned for a feature film. When he was a teenager, he committed armed robberies as an associate of the Gambino mafia family. But while he was serving a 10-year sentence in federal prison, he turned his back on the criminal life through his discovery of the works of Joyce and Proust and the teachings of Orthodox Judaism. He describes his personal redemption in a book called Unlocked, A Journey from Prison to Proust. The memoir is published by HarperCollins, and it is my pleasure to welcome Mr. Ferranti to the show today. Hi.
Hello, Lennon. I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Where did you grow up, and what was your upbringing like?
I grew up in Queens, in Flushing specifically, and I did have a very good upbringing. I had really good parents that instilled in me very good ethics and, you know, right from wrong. They taught me from when I was young. But as I got older, I was very rebellious, and I lost direction. And although my parents are very beautiful, good-hearted people, they really probably couldn't supply me with the proper guidance as far as education and stuff. And little by little, I strayed. But it's probably on account of myself, not my parents, that my rebellious nature, that I just liked doing risky things.
And how old were you when you started doing risky things, when you started committing criminal acts?
I was young. I was very, very young. We stole car batteries when we were little kids, and from there, we stole cars, and we had eventually I graduated to running my own chop shop. We cut the heads off parking meters in municipal parking lots with a pipe cutter that my friend's father had in his garage. And so.
And you were doing all this as freelancers, you and your
friends?
Yeah,
just as kids, just half horsing around, half let's make a buck, you know, just the way we were. And you know, we all came from decent families, too. We were just crazy kids.
And you became hijackers, in effect.
I did eventually. I hijacked my first truck. I was 17, and I realized that I liked it, which was a bad thing.
Now, what does hijacking a truck mean? First of all, you have to know that there's something of value in the truck. When I see a truck by, I have no idea whether that truck is empty or full, mm-hmm. or whether it has something that has $10,000 mm-hmm. a piece merchandise or 10-cent a piece merchandise.
When we first started out, we were young and we didn't have any connections, and we just, what they call, grabbed the truck on the blind. If we saw a truck that we thought had a particular name on it, such and such electronics or such and such whatever it might be, took a shot. During the day, it should be loaded. Or, you know, as we got more and more connected with people, we began to get what they call quote-unquote give-ups, which is when somebody comes to you and says, hey, my friend delivers for such and such a company, and he'd like to give you his truck, and he's got a $500,000 worth of goods in it on Friday. And then we would make the preparation ahead of time before we even took the truck, where it's going, the destination, the drop-off, the fence, what we're getting paid, if assuming the load is what it is. And the driver reports the incident as a hijacking and says he was abducted.
And gets a piece of the action. You had to have a fence, as you said. But at this point, you're still free of organized crime?
Yeah, at one point or another, I wrote in the book that they'll find you. If you're making money on the street and you have a name for yourself through a series of relationships, I eventually did get in with the Gambino crime family.
John Gotti.
I chose I made a big decision. I was in my paperwork, they connected me with the entire Gotti family. My phone records went back and forth to certain people, but I chose not to talk about, I chose not to cooperate to begin with when I did get arrested and sent away to prison. And then when I got the book deal, they asked me to give names and they offered me a lot more money, and I chose not to. I said I didn't give names then and I don't want to now. So, and there's a few Gottis right now having legal troubles. So I'd probably shy away from going that direction.
So you're telling me you don't want to talk about that part of it, but
I'd rather not.
But
yeah.
But you were doing this at a time when the mafia was losing its power. A lot of guys had been arrested. Would this have been different if you had been doing all these hijackings and related crimes 20 years earlier?
It may have been. Things were different, definitely, before my time. Things had been beginning to change. I was starting to—I was taught a sort of quote-unquote code of ethics, mafia ethics, from certain old-timers that are no longer alive or in jail. And that code of ethics that I was taught when I was introduced into this life, that life rather, I saw it begin to deteriorate right before my eyes, where people were greedy or doing things that I felt were wrong.
They were squealing.
And squealing. That's what the ultimate betrayal ended up being. When I was present when the first mobster got news that Sammy the Bull went sour, I was there. I was the first one who spoke to him. He had just left the lawyer's office, and I was with his son, actually, and we got the news together, and I said, wow, I didn't believe it. I'll be honest with you. I wrote about it in a book. I thought it was some type of ploy where he was going to pretend to squeal and maybe double-cross the government. And the only reason I'm mentioning his name is because he did squeal.
Yeah, well, he not only did that, he got himself in trouble later. He just seemed to be a bad guy.
Yeah, a lot of those people are bad seeds. When you see somebody squealing their way out of trouble that did all these horrible things and they didn't pay the price, they weren't necessarily punished for what they did, what's really deterring them from doing it again?
But why did you feel so bound by that? You weren't a made man.
I was absolutely. I would have had I stayed on the street. I would have been, and I would have been welcomed into that life when I came home. Actually, I bumped into somebody who couldn't wait to what they say is put you up for initiation, and he was surprised when I said no. I said I'm a Jew, and I went a different way, and I'm a writer. And he says, I heard all that. It's true. You know, he didn't really. So I said, yeah, I said, it's really true. So he was proud of me, though. He ended up being a really good guy, and he was happy for me. And that's yeah, I would have been.
Well, Jimmy Breslin was here recently to talk about how things have changed, and he kind of misses all the old colorful characters who used to hang out at, what was it, Pepe's Bar?
I wasn't familiar with Pepe's. I was from Queens.
But Pat McGuire's?
Yeah, those are probably Manhattan places, especially if Jimmy frequented them. I did hear his interview. It was great, and he made a lot of good points. It is a different class of people now.
So how did the authorities become aware of you? You're committing these crimes. I would have thought they would have been on your tail fairly early.
Believe it or not, we were really good at what we did. I had a crew of – I was taken down by the federal government when I was 24. Actually, I was indicted by several law enforcement institutions. Secret Service was indicted me for one crime.
So that's 7 or 8 years before they even found you.
I had a good long run.
Did you think it would be forever? You know people wind up being arrested.
No, I thought I was too smart and I'd go on forever and I'll one day be the boss of this family. I'm just, you know, I'm the smartest guy and the toughest guy that had ever lived. And rude awakening when you get locked up.
How long were you sentenced for?
I was 24. I was facing the rest of my life. When they combined the charges that I had, three separate indictments and a fourth, which was a superseder, I faced 125 years. And eventually what happened was, I guess, whether the case fell apart or the government felt like, for whatever reason, it wasn't worth trying it, but they did offer us, me and my co-defendants, pleas that we could live with. My ultimate plea was 12 and a half years. Which I pled guilty to. I pled guilty to my crimes, received a 12-and-a-half-year sentence, and I reversed it while I was away, and I got out after 8.5 years.
Well, usually they only offer you those kinds of deals if you are willing to talk.
If you're willing to talk, usually either do no time or a maximum of like 3 or 4 years. Nobody does a decade if they talk, and not unless you murdered 1,000 people, and even then you get out.
Do you have any idea of how much money you stole? I don't know what word to use.
I have no idea.
Along the way?
I know how much money the lawyers stole from me. I don't know how much money I stole, but they took everything that I had left.
Louis Ferrante, Ferrante, his book Unlocked, A Journey from Prison to Proust. It's published by HarperCollins. So what were your first reactions when you walked into federal prison? You must have known some of the guys there.
Yeah, at one point or another, I knew more people inside than I had known outside. I mean, the whole neighborhood was in with me. My entire neighborhood, all of my acquaintances, little by little, they eventually locked us all up until there was more of us inside than there was outside.
So that must have made it a little easier because prison can be really rough for somebody who doesn't have connections.
Yeah, the first 3 years I was in a holdover, which is very... very confined. It's very closed in. There's no outdoor recreation, or we didn't have any at that time. It was an old building in Brooklyn. I was there 3 years, 36 months exactly. The skin on my face peeled off. I was pale white as a ghost. I think the skin peeled from artificial lighting after so long, you know, skin beneath my eyes. Then I was sent from there. There was a lot of us there, a lot of wise guys there. I went to Lewisburg Penitentiary, which was a zoo. My first day in population, the Aryan Nation moved on the black Muslims, and they targeted two in their cell, chopped them up, hacked them to death.
There's a lot of racial division in those big prisons.
Definitely.
Now, why is that even allowed?
It's not that it's allowed or disallowed. It's that it is. Why is it allowed in society? It's not, but it exists. So just imagine when, you know, if it exists in normal society, take 1,200 murderers and cram them into a little place and expect them not to have race, you know, a racist attitude is, you know, just it'd be so far off.
There's a scene in Goodfellas where a mob captain is sent to prison and spends his stay making lavish Italian feasts. I think, was it Danny Aiello?
I forget, but...
Does that actually happen?
It does. I'll tell you where it happened.
Paul Sorvino.
It's Paul Sorvino, that's correct. In Lewisburg, it was very, very, very rough because of the race war, because of the tension, because in a moment, you know, someone could get killed. I carried a machete wherever I went. I strapped it to my waist when I went to the showers. I kept it in a slit in my mattress when I slept. I was one of only three whites on my Tia block, and the blacks vowed revenge. And I am olive-skinned, but I'm close enough if there's nobody with blonde hair and blue eyes nearby. So that was very difficult. We couldn't really – we didn't have chances and enough of us to commune. When I was in a medium security, we did. We cooked a lot. We ate a lot together. There's a piece in my book where I said we had Christmas dinner together, and we – you know, took two ping pong tables, pushed them together. Who made spaghetti aglio olio? Who made the mozzarella and tomatoes? And we enjoyed ourselves. We had a swag Walkman with paper cup speakers, and we played Frank Sinatra.
So there's a wide range. You go from being totally dehumanized,
absolutely,
to being given a lot of free.
Yeah. When I left the penitentiary, the counselor said to me, "Hey, Ferrante, you left a really bad place, a place where you have to kill or be killed." He says, "You're not in that place anymore. Get it through your head before you enter the compound. You do not have to kill anyone. Nobody's trying to kill you." He goes, "One F up, and you're on a bus back to the pen. Do a nice, easy bid." And it was the best advice I could have got, Lenny, and he was right.
Well, a lot of people promise that they're never going to go back, and then they wind up back.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what happened with you? How did you – what determined your way of turning your life around?
I began to read. I began to ask questions, I should say. That was the first step. I was in solitary confinement. Had a fight. I was in for a couple different reasons. One was my own fault. Another one, I took the rap for somebody else. But at one point or another, I was in the hole. And I always knew everything. I always had all the answers. For the first time in my life, I began to ask questions and realized that I wasn't so smart. I was actually, in fact, very dumb. And my choices were horrible. This wasn't the way I was raised, you know, to rob people, to tie them up, to put guns in their mouths. This is a horrible thing. And to live that life, you think it's normal. There's nothing to it, Lenny. Yeah, I wrote about how wacky we were if we saw a truck and we were at a stoplight. Just jump out at the light, jump on the truck, I'll follow you, grab the gun, it's under the seat. So
part of the pleasure is actually putting it over on somebody else.
Yeah, there's a lot of those things that go into the mix, absolutely. A lot of human frailties, you know, as far as mentally, you know, I'm putting one over on somebody.
That's what con men are all about.
Yeah,
they get
absolutely.
This great pleasure. It doesn't matter if it's an old lady who's going to lose everything, you know. Well, I fooled her and I got it.
Yeah. Well, we did try to we never robbed. We, like I said, in our twisted code of ethics, we if Lenny Lopate had his own Budweiser route and you were to lose if it was robbed, we didn't rob it. But if you work for Budweiser and Budweiser could pay for it, well then. And I forgive me if I can't use Budweiser on the air, but
no,
then,
it's okay.
Okay, then we.
I understand. You thought it was okay to rob a corporation,
yeah,
but not some guy you knew.
Yeah.
But then you wind up reading these great writers. It's a big leap between, well, I'm going to learn something,
yeah,
and I'm, yeah, going to read James Joyce and Marcel, yeah, Proust.
Absolutely. I read all the 19th century classics, which I love the most.
What led you to that? Did somebody say, hey, here's George Eliot. You might find this interesting.
I called up. No, actually not. One book led to another. I called up a friend of mine, and he worked in a social club in Queens, and he had tattoos from head to toe, and he had all biblical verses on his body. I said, hey, the guy has biblical verses all over himself. He must have read the Bible. He was the only guy I could think of that read. So I called him up. I said, can you send me some books in? And he said, sure. What do you want, Playboy, Penthouse? I said, no, real books. So he says, oh, really? He says, yeah, sure. What kind of books? I said, I don't know. Go ask the lady at the store or somebody. I really didn't know where to begin. And he sent me Caesar's Gallic Wars, Mein Kampf, and Napoleon by Vincent Cronin. Well, that's a pretty heavy read. You know, all three of them.
So, well, the Mein Kampf, of course, would have prepared you for working with those white supremacists.
So anyway, I really, really used to just read the back, look at the pictures, and I was so fearful, I guess, of beginning because it was a challenge. It was more challenging than sticking up a truck.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually I opened up the books and I got through all three of them and I made a promise to myself that I would write down every vocabulary word that I didn't know and look it up in a dictionary and study it that evening. And I did that. And one book led to another and I pushed through them and I asked for more. And eventually I had friends and family sending books in. I wiped out the prison library. And I realized that I took a view like this. I think I began with the ancient classics and the 19th century fiction because I said if these books stood the test of time, they have to be good. They have to be good, and there has to be a reason.
And what did your fellow inmates think of all of this? Has Louis gone totally crazy?
Yeah, at first, absolutely. There were some mobsters that were encouraging in the very beginning because I was playing pinochle, drinking coffee, smoking a cigarette with these guys, and the next day I'm laying on my bunk. I don't want to be bothered. And so they come by looking for me, and when I tell them, hey, you know, I got a lot of time ahead of me, I could end up being here, you know, at the time before I took the plea, I said I could end up being here forever. I want to make use of the time. My mother died in my arms when I was a kid, and I knew that life was fleeting. And I said, what am I doing? I really want to do something with myself.
But you also must have felt enriched by these books.
Absolutely. Each one was a challenge and ended up being a triumph when I put it down.
Now, a lot of people also have religious conversions, mm-hmm, in prison. They become born-again Christians. They become Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're the first person I've ever heard who converted to Orthodox Judaism.
I was the first person I ever encountered, too, in prison. You know, a friend of mine recently said to me, Ruta, of woman I know recently said to me, she goes, Lou, I hear about all these guys who go to jail and find Jesus. You're the only one who found Moses. So,
well, how did that happen?
I took a very, very careful, methodic approach to religion. First, I had to have the understanding that there's a God. And that eventually came through knowledge, through reading, through books. I would eventually say to myself, gee, the sun rises and sets. It rains. The rain feeds the plants. The plants nourish us. There's something going on here. There's a higher power at work. Then my next step was, how do I begin to worship this higher power or learn about this higher power, I should say? Where do I begin? So I read, obviously, I began with my own religion, which was Roman Catholicism. I read the Gospels, and then I moved on to the Bhagavad Gita, the Upanishads, the Quran. And eventually, I read the Torah, and the Torah sat well with me. I believed in it. I believed that that's what my inside told me was true. And then I studied the history of religions. And it seemed that all the monotheistic religions, Christian and Muslim alike, have some form of Torah in them. So the Torah seems to be the foundation, but I kind of saw that everybody was saying, let's take the book and say the Jews are wrong. So,
and then you started writing,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
And you also appealed your conviction. Is that why you're out?
That's correct. Well, that's why I was cut. My sentence was cut short, and I was out after 8.5 years.
Now, if you hadn't gone to prison, maybe you would have wound up dead.
Absolutely. It could have happened. They're very greedy people and evil people in that life. And I was away with some guys, and I'd hear the reasons why people were killed because I'd be talking to the killers. And listening to them reading their indictments and talking about their own indictments and charges together, I'd say, gee, that guy got killed for that. You know, you heard somebody might have disappeared. So-and-so disappeared. You heard about it on the street. You didn't ask questions. You couldn't ask questions. If you did, they'd want to know why you're asking questions. Maybe you disappeared next week. So you just, that was life. And when I was away, I'd hear why the person got killed. And it was usually over a buck. And I'd say, wow, son of a gun. That's why that poor guy got killed, over a buck.
What happened to the guys you used to run with when you were a teenager? Are most of them in prison?
Several of them were locked up with me.
Any of them reading Proust, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I hope they are. I truly hope they are, Lenny.
I'm assuming that this book is going to lead to other books, that now yes. You see yourself as a writer.
I wrote a novel about the antebellum South while I was in prison. But
antebellum South.
And everywhere I went when I came home, everybody said, Italian mobster turned Jew writes a book about the antebellum South. You got to be kidding me. And nobody would read it. But so a friend of mine, David Black, kept pushing me, Lou, you got to write your own story. And eventually I broke down and did.
And Louis Ferranti will be speaking and signing books this coming Monday, or the Monday after, April 7th at 7 o'clock at McNally Robinson Bookstore at 52 Prince Street. That's between Lafayette and Mulberry Streets. The book Unlocked, A Journey from Prison to Proust, is published by HarperCollins. Thank you so much for being with us, and congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Lenny.